Right now, that's Roswell Rudd playing We Shall Overcome with Charlie Hayden Liberation Music Orchestra, arranged by Carla Bley. That's a 1966 recording. My name is Dave Douglas, and you're listening to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. I'm going to be talking to Roswell today and listening to a lot of his music and different things he's been involved in over the years. Thanks for listening to the podcast. This is our 40th episode. There's a whole bunch of great music and conversation in the other episodes that you can get at iTunes, or you can listen to them directly at the greenleafmusic.com website. You can also email me at podcast@greenleafmusic.com. You could leave a review or a rating at iTunes. That helps to get the word out. I'll be continuing through the year interviewing great figures in our music, and I am super thrilled to be with Roswell Rudd today. Before getting into the interview, I want to play a piece that goes back 60 years. It was recorded in 1957 with a group called Eli's Chosen Six that was a popular college Dixieland band in New England that Roswell played in. And here is a bit of them featuring Roswell on Basin Street Blues.
What a great tune.
Great tune, great playing. I mean, there must have been some early influences for you in that music, would you say? You were just telling me about hearing jazz at the Philharmonic in 51.
Yeah.
Were there, and no trombone players featured, but there were a lot around.
Not on that session. But I guess I had heard recordings of jazz at the Philharmonic. Quite a few were already out before 1951.
Mm.
And so I heard some trombone on those. But this music that Eli's Chosen Six is playing here, which is called, or which we called New Orleans or Dixieland at the time, that, I won't call it a label, but that term stuck with me, Dixieland. And when I eventually got down to New York City and was improvising freely mm-hmm. with other people I discovered down there, I called it Dixieland. And they were saying, no, this is free jazz, this is improvised ensemble playing. Dixieland is something else. But my experience of Dixieland was basically the improvisational part that goes into making the music live.
The collective playing.
Yeah, the give it the aliveness. Yeah. We had arrangements, as you can hear, mm-hmm. but there were times when it just went for chorus after chorus in live performance, where I guess I would have to just call it free jazz.
So you think even like when you were playing with people like Cecil Taylor, Buell Neidlinger, who was in Eli's...
Buell Neidlinger, yeah. This is where Eli's Chosen Six came from.
Uh-huh.
Buell Neidlinger, myself, my father, and some other people that he was in school with at Yale at the time. I hadn't gotten there yet. Mm-hmm. But this was kind of a Central Connecticut Dixieland band.
You mean you were still in high school?
Mm-hmm.
Hotchkiss.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think I was in my first year of Yale when we did this recording. I had just finished my first year, but Eli's Chosen Six had been going on for a while.
But within a couple of years, you were in New York and with Herbie Nichols and with... And you met Steve Lacy mm-hmm. right around then, and...
Yeah, by 1959, 1960, I was really in New York City. Mm. And trying to get those people up into where I was living so we could have some sessions.
Oh.
And that was successful from time to time, and then I was going out to hear them and finding loft sessions to play in. And...
Wow. Just before we move on, I want to ask about the Lomax research job that mm-hmm. you had, maybe around that time, maybe a little earlier, field recordings?
That would have been in 1964.
Oh, so it was later?
Yes.
And you were involved in collecting recordings?
Well, mm-hmm. he was, really.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I was called in as what... was termed a coder because Alan Lomax and I'll think of his name, a very astute musicologist, had developed a system called cantometrics, mm-hmm. literally measuring the song, 37 different ways to listen to any given piece of music, to give it a profile that could then be put into a computer and matched with other profiles.
So your task was to analyze the recordings.
Exactly. I spent day after day, sometimes 12 hours a day, listening and doing the coding for a variety of songs.
But and this is at the same time that you're playing with Steve Lacy the music of Thelonious Monk, which at that time not too many people were doing other than Thelonious Monk, right?
Mm-hmm. I think with Lacy it goes back to Dixieland because he actually played with Eli's Chosen Six sometimes when the regular clarinetist couldn't play. Mm. And Steve was very... Dixieland-oriented as well as with modern jazz. And I got to know him that way. And if you would check me out in 1957, I would have been down there on Bleecker Street, sleeping in Steve's loft, and going to the five spot to hear him and Cecil Taylor, Dennis Charles, and Buell Nightlinger over there.
The yeah.
Old one. Yeah.
Great band.
Yeah. Not bad. Over there in
you
the
know,
corner.
I never thought about it this way, but it's funny because when I moved, you know, this is obviously much later, 84 was when I moved to New York, but I sort of felt like I was playing straight ahead jazz and sort of avant-garde electric music at the same time. And so I'd be on these outlandish gigs in the far Lower East Side, and then the next night I'd be, you know, playing mainstream straight ahead, you know, bebop. And the worlds aren't as far apart as people like to think they are, you know?
And, no,
and,
they're
and
not.
The fact that you guys were so heavily implicated in all of that different activity simultaneously is a real...
No, I heard a lot of Dixieland and Thelonious Monk. A lot of Dixieland and New Orleans.
And in Herbie Nichols probably too, right?
And Herbie Nichols too, yeah.
I'm just going to take a musical interlude and we'll hear a little bit of Monk's Mood with you and Steve.
Okay.
From 1963, right? School Days.
Yeah, School Days, yeah.
Monk's Mood.
You
said the story of this recording was really interesting.
Yeah, the place on Bleecker Street on the corner of Bleecker and 7th Avenue South, I think it was called Take 3, Take 5. I forgot it. One of those takes, seems to me. I'd have to look at the album to get the information. But... we had a friend, a mutual friend, probably more my friend than Steve's, who lived on the same street that I did in NoHo, which was, Double Soho, which was Chambers Street, way down, a Canadian poet, Paul Haynes had a loft further down on Greenwich Avenue. And he was a big jazz fan, very big fan of the music. And when he heard that Steve and I were playing in this place, he was determined to record it somehow, and was very surprised that we hadn't done so sooner, because he said it was just an incredible band. So he borrowed a tape recorder, and he came in and put that microphone up for a couple of sets one night. And that's how we got that music out. I have to think a minute about the name of it.
How did you guys learn the Thelonious Monk songs? Like from the record or?
A combination of going to hear him and transcribing from recordings. And listening to other people play his music, too. But much to learn there.
Yeah, there still is.
And it was just so clear.
Who else was playing Monk tunes at that time?
You know, it's hard for me to think of anybody but Thelonious Monk at the time and the great bands that he had then playing that music. Mm-hmm. So I'm not, at the moment, able to come up
even within different bands that he had, the tunes would shift a little bit and be played slightly differently, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, there was a tremendous influence, especially as far as getting inside the sound and learning some very specific things compositionally.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, applying that to your own musical personality. So it was, you know, it was going to school. I think that's a very appropriate title, School Days.
Yeah.
Because it was like a conservatory, delving into this music. And at the same time, both of us carrying on other musical lives. I know that Steve was with Gil Evans a lot at the time, and I was doing my Dixieland gigs and whatever else I could do.
I heard you guys play that music years later, and then had the great good fortune to be invited by you guys to join the horn section for some Monk performances.
That was a great quintet day.
It was really. With Jean-Jacques Avanel and
that's
John
right,
Betch.
John Betch and Jacques.
But I remember the first time I heard you guys do it live, because I had only heard it on record, of course, because mm-hmm. you guys were doing other things. And I went up to Steve after the show and I said, oh, that music is so complete. You know, because you guys were playing all the inner parts and the moving
right.
high tone lines and
yep.
correct
three parts.
Harmonies. And
yep.
and Steve looked at me really annoyed and he said, of course it's complete. I learned a lot from him.
Yeah. Start there. It's
yeah.
complete.
Okay. transition here to a question that was sent to me by Ryan Keberly, the trombonist. He wants to know...
You know Ryan. I spent some time with him.
Great trombone player, composer.
Yeah.
He wants to know, is there any one thing that you practice every day?
I practice getting as far into the sound as I possibly can.
Mm.
And then I start working with sound. And more I'm doing that. And I think it's consistent with the way that I started with the early music. Those players were so into sound.
Hmm.
And I'm talking about live performance, the kind of sounds that came later in recordings and in bands generally where there was a lot of section work. You could call it more symphonic.
But you mean the tone generation, or do you mean like conceptually in your inner musical ear, the sound?
Both ways.
How it
sounds inside.
Yeah.
How it sounds in the room, and how you think it's going to sound for other people.
Mm.
So,
that's
the early players that I came to New York originally to get next to, they had this quality of being able to work the sound and get off into the edges sonically.
Huh.
More than what came later.
You mean doing like different sonic approaches to the instrument itself?
Well, I'm talking about things like growl,
mm-hmm.
Using the plunger, sounding more like singers. Different ways to color the sound and to express emotionally what you feel. And, you know, using those possibilities.
Wow. That's a... lifetime of practice.
Yeah, it's still there. I'm still doing it, still perfecting it, because I still am changing, Dave.
Yeah.
Even after all this time, you think, well, I must have settled into a groove by now. But as soon as I pick that horn up, it starts kicking my ass, and there's something else, something else to work on.
Oh, boy. Sometimes I feel like I'm the only one, so I'm glad to hear you say that.
Come on. You're right on, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. I want to play a tune of yours that you recorded with Archie Shepp.
Oh, Archie, I was just...
Live in San Francisco in 1966, right?
66, that's right.
With Louis Worrell,
yeah.
And Beaver Harris.
That's right.
Great band. So
what
we're going to hear a little bit of... maybe we'll hear the whole thing. It's not that long. It's a beautiful piece called Keep Your Heart Right.
Oh. Well, that's a kind of a short version of the song.
Yeah.
But
set breaker, right?
I think it's the first time I ever had an original song on a corporate label.
Wow.
Like Impulse.
It was on Impulse, yeah.
Yeah. So that was a step.
That's great.
Yeah.
You had played on some sessions with Cecil Taylor on Impulse. Mm-hmm. That came out under Gil Evans's name.
Yeah.
But this was a real band with Archie Shepp.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, Archie and I had been rehearsing really since 1960, 61.
Hmm.
And a lot on our own, you know, not only playing other people's material, but we were in the process of getting ourselves together as composers. Mm. And that kept up right through 1966 and kept going for a while after that. And periodically since then, in the 21st century,
yeah,
other
yeah.
things were happening.
But at that time in the mid-60s, traveling with Shep and that band must have been really something.
Yes, it was something. It was a great
experience. In a lot of ways.
Well, it was a great experience. In a way, we were doing it ourselves more than anybody managing us or saying, go here, go there. So it was a great way to start off. And we had actually been doing it for some time. You know, I had been doing it with Eli's Chosen Six on the weekends. And then when I got to New York City, I was just out there on the street and around in the clubs.
Setting up gigs.
Seeing what I could get.
Doing your own booking and management, as it were.
Exactly, yeah.
Building the whole thing up.
That's right.
From the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with Shep's group as well.
Yeah, that continued.
Hmm.
That feeling.
So live in San Francisco, even though it was recorded for a major label, Impulse, it kind of have a, you know, it was a self-made event. You guys booked a small room and got some microphones and tape gear.
Yeah.
And
we were supposed to stay for 1 week, And then we were there for 2 weeks, and then our families were saying, where are you? You were supposed to come back 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we were out there all together for about a month.
Wow.
And the Both And, as a club, became transformed into a jazz dining and listening place, mm-hmm. more than it ever had been before.
Mm.
And then Sonny Rollins, Miles Davis, I think Coltrane appeared there eventually.
So they became a national venue,
mm-hmm.
for touring.
We kind of established it, yeah.
Wow.
And pretty soon there was just no room to put people when they came to hear it, because the word got around.
Yeah.
And San Francisco being a kind of a live nerve place, mm-hmm. at the time.
Yeah.
Crowds welled and welled.
Was the New York Art Quartet a similar situation with Milford Graves and John Chakai? Like, you guys were booking that yourselves?
Yes.
This is, I guess, right around the same time, right?
Mm-hmm. I can remember going to Denmark and teaming up with John over there,
mm.
and with a drummer from Africa, and bass player from Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
Louis Maholo, mm-hmm. was the drummer from Africa,
wow.
newly arrived into Denmark.
Yeah.
And Finn von Eiben was a Danish guy who, mm-hmm. was a lovely bass player. So the New York Art Quartet didn't quite get transposed 100% outside of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
With Milford Graves, it was basically right here. And I think there may have been one or two concert performances in Europe. I can think of one with Milford.
Uh-huh.
And not sure who was on the bass at that one. But it was always a pleasure to play with John. And the nucleus of what we started with, of course, was John, myself, and Milford.
Yeah.
And we could add whatever we wanted to that.
I was going to play a little bit of this tune, Old Stuff.
Old Stuff, yeah.
Dixieland.
Dixieland.
So I was listening to all of your music for the last few days preparing to do this, and there's so much that, you know, this could be a much, much longer show, but I'm gonna skip a few years. I'm gonna ask you about what I would say has become a big, well, has become, it's been a lot of years, but bringing in music from other traditions into Dixieland, or as you, I would say jazz, or I would say new music, but I think like, I'm gonna skip ahead to 1976 and Blown Bone.
76.
Where it feels like there's a new bringing in of other sorts of traditions and other sorts of players into the music.
I think the Alan Lomax project that I was a part of and my function there, I listened to a lot of field recordings from around the world, all kinds of traditional music and art music. And I know that this had an influence on me across time. I started with Lomax in 64, and it went for 20 years after that on and off, sometimes more on and off. But I was lucky to be at the listening end of a lot of very rare recordings from all over the place. In fact, I walked into Lomax's office the first day that I was there, and I said, "Do Eskimos have music?" I didn't know. I really hadn't gone that far beyond my own, let's say, United States. But there it is, Alaska. And there was a lot that I hadn't heard, of course. And, you know, I'd heard some folk singers, blues singers, and some early music. But fascinating.
So you feel like when you heard these other musics, it opened up a new area in your creative thinking?
Yes, it did. But there was something already in me from the jazz experience that I could say was, that I could say helped me get inside the other music that I was hearing.
I'm going to play a little bit of, I want to play a little bit of Bethesda Fountain from Blown Bone.
Oh, good.
Bethesda Fountain.
Yeah.
And that's you playing thumb piano at the beginning.
Yeah, I'm on there with the thumb piano.
Wow. I mean, it seems like a big change It's not that much after what was happening in the 60s, right? And bringing all this into your music, I mean, it's not Dixieland anymore.
Oh, come on, Dave. Dixieland goes all the way back.
And all the way into the future,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. It's always got to be there.
Wow. Well, how did you, like, for example, meeting Toumani Diabaté? How did that come about?
Well, actually, that came about through Verna Gillis.
Uh-huh.
Because she had been to Mali and was in touch with some of the great players in Mali in music. And it's through her contacts that eventually I was able to get to Mali and to play with Toumani.
And then you made this record with him.
A couple of years later, we did this.
Mali Cool.
That's right.
And he came to the States.
He was here sort of in the capacity of an artist in residence from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And going around to various universities. And she was really impressed by his musicality and the way that he was able to talk with other people about it.
And you were able to write music specifically for him.
Yeah, this is a few years later.
Uh-huh.
From the initial thing that Verna had started. And we got over to Mali in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some spontaneous playing with Toumani and some of the other musicians in Bamako at that time.
Mm.
But the recording session itself was about 2 years later. And it was, you know, it had to be prepared for and set up in advance. And I will say on that particular recording, I'm very proud of the trombone sound on there. It was done in a house trailer on the main street.
Huh.
And it was an engineer from Paris who had, I think, made Bamako his home after a while.
Wow.
And he had such beautiful control over that space and just made it very natural for the players. And the sound's fantastic.
Let's hear a little bit. Great trombone sound, Mali Cool. And you doubled a lot of those trombone parts, right? This is with the engineer there in Bamako.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That was an amazing experience.
Okay, so like more recently, another project you did is called Blue Mongol.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Again, through
Verna Gillis,
yeah.
Traveling.
And people from Mongolia reaching out to.
Wow.
And traveling over there, and they're coming here and traveling here.
You've done a lot of collaborations like this with trombone shout bands and shell orchestra. What was another thing that I heard you do? Oh boy, there's so many.
Let's see, in New Orleans, the trombone band down there.
Well, let's listen to a little Blue Bongo. Say that again?
Rubato singing and playing. In other words,
in Mongolian music.
Free time.
Uh-huh.
Just, it's like holding a drone.
Yeah. And there's also some microtonal elements to it as well, wouldn't
very,
you say?
Very microtonal in the singing and in the plucking and bowing that I heard.
Gives
I didn't
it a
get around
blues.
The long trumpets.
Uh-huh.
But they're very well recorded, I think. You can hear them.
Yeah.
And, wow, you know, go to a library and take them out.
Something else. And you just handed me a stack of recent albums that I'm going to get into. And I mm-hmm. heard the record you made with Heather Massey. And I just want to say thank you for allowing me to come up here and chat with you. We haven't played in a long time.
Listen, it's been wonderful getting back together with you for a minute. And I just want to say that all of this travel and playing with musicians from other lands, et cetera, has just increasingly helped my understanding of sound and what I can do with it as far as expressing myself and what I can pass on to other people about it. But really, the expression of one's self through sound is what I've learned so much about working with whoever I've been lucky enough to work with over the years. It's always seemed to come down to sound and how far inside of that you can get to make
you feel
revealed.
The more you listen internationally and globally, the more it opens you up to the sound inside yourself.
Yeah, just the act of listening wherever you are, whatever the music is, and being able to be on the outside of it as well as on the inside of it through, you know, your own listening powers.
Boy, we're going to need a lot of that in these coming few years.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the inspiration. Thanks for all the music.
Hey, you're welcome, Dave.
And,
my pleasure. Our pleasure.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you, Roswell.
You too. I'm glad we could get together.